Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever,
where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, or most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Claire and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today. That is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded. And today, we'd also like to acknowledge elders past and present of the Gadigal people, because this interview is coming to you from Sydney, where Claire and I are thrilled to be speaking to medical historian and public history advocate extraordinaire, Dr. Peter Hobbins. Peter is the author of Venomous Encounters, Snakes, Vivisection and Scientific Method, published in 2017, and he's also worked on the history of quarantine, disease and epidemics. His co-authored book on Sydney's former quarantine station, Stories from the Sandstone, was awarded the Community and Regional History Prize at the 2017 New South Wales Premier's History Awards. When COVID hit last year, Peter's expertise in the 1918 influenza pandemic, the last major pandemic, saw him thrust into the media spotlight. As we all looked to the past to make sense of the bewildering present, Peter went on TV and radio to help us understand what the hell was going on. And in 2021, Peter has started a new role heading up the knowledge team at the Australian Maritime Museum. And he's also an honorary associate at the University of Sydney, where he's worked for many years. So welcome to Archive Fever, Peter.
Thank you. And I'd also like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose Bamal and Badu we meet today.
We'll talk more about the pandemic in a moment, but I'd first like to go back to where your Archive Fever began. Did it start with your PhD in history, or did it date back much earlier?
I have a strange career as a historian because I've always loved history, which is why I stopped studying it. And that might sound a bit weird, but basically I got to the end of year 11 at high school and I loved history, but I decided not to do it in year 12 because I was going to be an Air Force pilot and I didn't need it to get into the Air Force. Now, I actually got into the Air Force, but decided not to join. This is in 1988, I should add. So when I went to university, I didn't do any history subjects. I studied some history and philosophy of science. But in the background, I always kept reading history. And it was only really when I was in my 30s that I started reading about the New Zealand Wars. And I thought, I didn't know about this. I didn't know there'd been conflict between Māori and Pākehā in New Zealand. And it really blew my mind. So that really, this is going back 2002, I started reading more deeply and started reading transcripts of primary documents. And I guess that's really where I started for the first time as a 35-year-old professional writer to think maybe I could actually look at some real primary sources and start doing history of my own. So that's really where the urge began. It was a long-held interest, but that's when it started to become an ambition.
And what does that urge feel like for you? Do you have a kind of particular sensation in your body when you get really excited by some primary documents?
Yeah, absolutely. I always think of myself as a communicator. I used to say I'm a writer, and these days I think of myself more as a communicator because I do like using different media. I'm often looking at artifacts and documents. And I think I use both of those sources a lot in my work. And I'm always thinking about how can I connect this? How can I tell this story? You know, what is it that comes out of it? And some of them you have the immediate affective response to. You think, wow, this is amazing. It's a handwritten journal. The sorts of things that many of us encountered and seen for the first time. But, you know, now that I work at the Australian National Maritime Museum, I've got a submarine in my archive, you know, literally, it's just out my window. And so that's exciting too, because I was walking past it on the way to the studio today and I thought that submarine embodies the Cold War. I mean, if you've read Paul Virilio, for instance, he was an archaeologist who wrote a lot in the 1970s and 80s about the speed of war and bunker mentality and the ways in which the Cold War changed response times and the way that people went further and further underground. And the submarine is sort of the maritime equivalent of that. Not Australian submarines, but many other submarines, of course, carried nuclear weapons on board. So they rapidly sped up the pace of warfare and they could approach the enemy coast, you know, the United States, Soviet Union, and yet the crew themselves were protected underwater. So in that one artifact on my walk to the studio today, these thoughts were triggering off in my head. So yeah, that's the sort of excitement I get out of dealing with primary sources, even if they're a submarine.
But is the experience palpably different for you from holding a, say, a 19th century diary in your hand or standing in front of a submarine? Is the quality of your archive fever different?
Naturally, there's the intimacy of dealing with written archives or with photographs as well. I mean, okay, to give you just another recent example, I was in an op shop last week and went down the back of the shop where stuff is donated, and there were a series of photo albums. From what I could tell, taken in Port Stephens in the 1950s, judging by the very high trousers and the people standing around holding up little fish. And I had to really back away and not try to buy that photo album, probably because the op shop was going to chuck it out, which would be sad. They often do that with personal albums. But there was that immediate intimate connection. I wanted to know, who were these people? What had they been doing, you know, in their little fishing expeditions? Why were they wearing those enormous pants? Who were the kids? How old are they now? So there is that immediate connection with photos, but also with written documents as well. I guess one of the more intimate encounters I remember having was with a tiny note. So I did a fellowship at the State Library of New South Wales a few years ago on a very quirky man called James Samuel Bray. I called him an entrepreneur. He thought of himself as a scientist or a natural historian. He was a bit of a wheeler dealer, bit of a dodgy geezer all round. And he ran a museum of curios in downtown Sydney, almost at Circular Quay. I went through his papers at the State Library. And I knew he'd had a mentorship from Gerard Krefft, who'd been the early director of the Australian Museum here in Sydney. When Krefft was dismissed summarily from the museum, I think James Samuel Bray's fortunes also went down. And yet there was this scrap of paper in his collection. It was literally a scrap, but it just had, "Dear Mr. Bray, come if you can, Mr. Krefft is dead." And it was signed by his wife. And there were watery blotches on it. Now, you were immediately imagining they are tears. Maybe not. Maybe it had been carried in the rain or something like that. But to me, just a short message like that was so intimate, and it told me so much about the relationship between those people at that moment, that he was who she called, you know, by messenger at that moment in 1881 when Gerard Krefft keeled over.
Eve and I both have goosebumps. Yeah. We're giving each other that conspiratorial, "Yep, I've got the goosebumps" feeling too.
Yeah, we have the fever as well. Of course, over the last year, Peter, we've all been living through history in the form of the COVID-19 pandemic. And while many of us, including myself, have spent a lot of that time doom scrolling, archivists and historians have been recording this history as it happens, creating archives of the pandemic. And you've been one of those people. That's one of the reasons we're really keen to talk to you today, is that you've been on the front line of that archival work. And I'm particularly interested in the hashtag you created, which is hashtag COVID Street Archive, to prompt ordinary people to document their experiences. Can you tell us about the kind of thinking behind setting that up?
I guess there are two ways into that. And it's funny that you mention it, because just today at work at the Australian National Maritime Museum, a colleague came up to you in the corridor and said, "Oh, you're Peter Hobbins. I contributed to COVID Street Archive." I was like, "Oh, wow, oh, good on you." And I didn't take that in an egotistical sense. I was just excited to see that so many people last March, April, May, in particular, when our world was descending, engaged with that idea of thinking, this is something that we need to document and we need to do it rapidly. And, you know, I'd worked in cultural institutions before. I knew about the inertia of getting initiatives off the ground. And so I saw its moment there, and I saw there was a real chance to come at it. So I guess there were two ways into it. One was that I'd been interested already, and I gave a talk at a postgraduate conference at the University of Sydney a few years ago that I called "Dumpster Diving in the Informal Archives." Because I'm a scrounger, like I mentioned before. I go into op shops and places like that. I find things on the side of the road. I have literally waded into dumpsters to pull out, you know, World War II documents and an autograph album from the early 1900s. And it got me thinking a lot about what happens to all of the material that doesn't go into formal collecting institutions, which is why I know that op shops generally will throw out personal diaries and letters and photo albums. They don't want to deal with that stuff. So I'd been interested in this idea of informal archives and the sorts of collecting that's done on the streets, quite literally. Then I guess my other way into it was that I'd just recently finished doing the graffiti project at the quarantine station. So that was where myself and a group of archaeologists, as well as historians, had been working on what were called historic inscriptions, which we tended to think of as carvings, but there were many that were painted or daubed or sometimes written in pen or pencil at the former quarantine station. And that's what made me really aware of the power of the informal as a primary source as well. And none of these were official documents, and yet they were an archive in place. They were literally carved into the sandstone at the quarantine station. And so working with archaeologists, and particularly phenomenological archaeologists, which means, you know, they like to stand there and actually look at artifacts and think about how they were created and try to get into the mentalities of the people who made these artifacts. What was their cosmology? What were they thinking? What did they believe? Did they think they were passing this on to the future, or was it just a momentary diversion? Both of those avenues sort of coalesced when I started seeing the little hand-drawn signs going up in the windows of shops, or the chalked rainbows outside of houses in my neighbourhood, or the teddy bears put up in people's windows.
Spoonville.
Yeah.
Did you have Spoonville in Sydney?
No, we didn't.
Sydney?
No,
Spoonvilles
no.
were very big in Melbourne.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
They were little villages of wooden spoons stuck into the ground with faces painted on the wooden spoons.
And then they'd grow over the weeks. Go hashtag Spoonville. You'll find them all over Instagram.
Oh, how awesome. And this was what I loved about it too. It was so vernacular. Mm. Just these things developed, and they were sort of memes on social media, but also on the streets as well. So there was that sort of flaneur sense where we were getting out and wandering the neighbourhood, trying to just break out of that enforced isolation, that I saw these things. I thought, this might be our chance. Mm. It might be our moment where we can actually, as a community, start tagging these things so they can be harvested and then brought together once the cultural institutions get a chance to get their schemes up and running. Some admirably did very quickly, but others generally took a couple of months, and that's where social media, I think, filled those first few months where people were informally tagging so that it could be scraped later on. Mm.
And so that process of scraping and then collecting up the ephemera, really, I mean, you couldn't get further from the submarine example that you've given us at the beginning in terms of material object and then these hashtags. Where does that end up? What's the repository? What is the physical archive, or how do people access? How will they access it now, and how will they access these archives in the future?
That's an excellent question, and I guess I had two responses to that. One was, of course, last year it wasn't my place to offer any of that because I was working in a private heritage consulting company. Well, I worked with other people. I don't want to claim all the credit for it. And in fact, I should give a big shout out to Bruce Baskerville, who's at the University of Western Australia, who contacted me in March and said, you know, I'm wondering about how to deal with these materials that are coming up out of the pandemic, you know, the handwritten signs. Are they actually potentially infectious? Should we handle them differently as archival materials because of that contact? So it was really Bruce who actually made me start thinking, how else can we respond to this? So big shout out to Bruce, who's been a great public historian for decades now. Because I wasn't in a cultural institution, I'd just been working at the National Archives of Australia and had left there. I was thinking a lot about digital archiving. So kind of threw the problem back at the institutions by putting it on social media and tagging them wherever I could. Particularly, I said people maybe should tag their relevant state library as a logical place to begin this work. And some of them, I think particularly the State Library of Victoria, jumped on it quite quickly. Others did when they could. I know the National Museum was very active as well in that space. So it was a problem I couldn't solve and didn't try to solve at the time. But coming down to the longer term issues, it's something that I really appreciate my time working at the National Archives of Australia to think about, you know, because we are facing a digital future. You know, most of us who work in history are very aware of the digital abyss that kicks in about 1995. And I've already been asking in my first week at the Australian National Maritime Museum, can we start accessioning data? Much as we have submarines and diaries and amazing Indigenous artworks from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists, we also need to be thinking about data sets, for instance, as we go into the decade of ocean science for sustainability. So there's lots of ways we need to be thinking about data as the future of history. What you need then is massive, sustainable digital infrastructure. And that's wonderful on one hand, because we had the technology to do that, but it creates a number of huge issues that I've had to think a little bit about. One of them is migration of data and migration of platforms. Now, I've done a little bit of work in my own research on what was once called electronic data processing, early computing. I'm not a computer geek and I'm not a computer history geek, but I got really interested in punched cards, the manual prelude to electronic data processing, and early floppy disks and those sorts of things. So I've been thinking about that migration of information from pianola rolls to punched cards to early computers to floppy disks to hard drives, cloud storage and so on. And we need to think not only about storing the data as zeros and ones, but how we actually can read that data in the future. And there have been many people who've thought a lot about this. The other thing I think we need to think about is who has the scale of facilities to gather, sort, store, archive, migrate, and promote all this material. And I really worry that this is going to have a major impact on community history. So the local history society or the family history society or the special interest groups like the ones I belong to in medical history or history of technology, they can collect photos and they can collect diaries and letters and manuscripts or ephemera, small run printed material. They can collect oral histories with people who are in that profession or that area or whatever. They can maybe mark out landmarks in the local vicinity. But how are they going to collect data? And how are they going to make sure that data has digital longevity and can be accessed in 100 years? Now, that's not all a sad story because, of course, there's a generational shift in here as well. People who, like my son, who's 19, who were born in a century that was digital, will hopefully be the people who volunteer to get involved in these organisations. Or they're the people that people like me, who now work in a cultural institution, will go out and target and say, we need your skills. We need you to be thinking about what's going on in your world, how we capture that now, and how we're going to make sure that's accessible and comprehensible in a century. So I guess these were some of the ideas that came out of the hashtag. It was a small little idea, but it sparked a whole lot of things that I'm now maybe able to enact in a little way in my current role.
And what was the most kind of interesting or surprising thing that came out of the hashtag? Did people tag things that you weren't expecting?
One of the things that struck me early on was the privacy issue. Mm. And so I personally started photographing signs, you know, handwritten signs generally, but also printed ones. And so one of the memes that came out of that to me was the different language used in those signs. Some of it was quite euphemistic. It often said in current circumstances, and it was almost like they didn't want to mention the pandemic, which had resonance for me with the quarantine station, where out of 1,600 inscriptions we documented over 150 years of history, three mentioned disease and none mentioned vaccination. Mm. So there was an interest there in what people weren't referring to. The other one was the number of people who were saying, we have to shut down because of the government. You know, it was some sort of government edict that was making them back away. Mm. And I think the third one was the interest in the customers as well. They were saying, dear customers, we really care about you and we're closing our doors because we value you and we don't want to compromise your health. So there's some interesting things that came out of just looking at the messaging within those. But I realized too late that I'd missed some golden opportunities too. And I was glad that other people did pick up on them. One of them, I think, was looking at crowds and seeing how they distanced over time. And if I'd been more clever and more foresighted, I would have taken photos of people on a daily or weekly basis to see how they moved apart and started bunching up together and then moving apart again. I think that would have been really interesting.
Time-lapse photography would be really interesting. Yeah. Like long-form time-lapse.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, you could easily use some digital humanities measures to look at how you measure those distances between people in photos. And the other one I think that we really missed out on, I feel quite sad about this, was the cultures of the people who didn't stay at home. Mm. These are the people who made it possible for the rest of us to, in inverted commas, stay at home, because they didn't. And I really think hard about Uber Eats or the Deliveroo riders, the people who went out on their electric bicycles, their phones strapped to the handlebars, who were out in the rain, exposing themselves to enormous contact risks themselves to deliver pizzas or other meals. which helped keep the hospitality economy ticking over. It kept money circulating. And as historians, we all know the danger from the Great Depression of money not moving around. And I think thirdly, you know, it just meant that they were the frontline workers in a really weird way. And so if you look at some of the commemoration that was going on last year, it was all about healthcare workers, emergency workers and so on. But nobody was thinking about that whole almost underground economy of food delivery that did keep things moving.
Peter, that's a fascinating point, thinking about the Uber Eats drivers, because as we know, you have to read archives for their silences as much as for their inclusions. Mm. And there are always people who have been silenced in the archives, whether they were illiterate or they weren't the people who other people were writing about. One of the things that, as Eve said in the introduction, has been very interesting for you is that you've been in the limelight over the last year because you had already did a good run in pandemic history. You had studied the Spanish flu and previous pandemics. And I was interested in one thing that you said: for the first time in my career, I feel a real sense of what could be called historical deja vu in living through the COVID-19 lockdown. So what are some of the parallels that you saw? And maybe I'm thinking through this lens as well of whose stories got recorded in the Spanish flu epidemic and how we know about how all of the people lived, or are there ways in which we don't know about how some people lived, like the Uber Eats drivers of 1919?
Well, that's a big question, so I'll break it down into chunks. I think that sense of deja vu is worrying because I'm not a big believer in cyclical history or in history repeating itself or learning lessons from the past. And so I really had to confront that sort of meta-historical bias last year and think, people were constantly asking me, you know, it was the constant question. If we're looking back at Spanish flu, and I'm doing scare quotes on the radio here because I don't like to call it Spanish flu. I tend to call it pneumonic influenza because A, that's historically what we officially called it in Australia, and B, we don't like to blame the Spanish for it because it didn't come out of Spain. But it was a good shorthand and it opened a lot of doors that way. So it did make me actually think about the circularity of history and those parallels. And I was actually surprised at my own self-insight to think this does feel like, for the very first time, all those senses that I'd read about from sources from 1918 and 19 were really coming into play. And luckily there were positive signs, I think particularly the community-mindedness, which was something that was really strong as we went into the pandemic last year. I think what was also interesting was the lack of blame game that we saw in other parts of the world, and that was partly officially mediated. You know, it was never called the Wuhan virus, it was always COVID-19, and I think we all responsibly took that on, and there was not actually a great deal of racialization that we may have seen, say, with bubonic plague or smallpox with previous outbreaks. And that actually made me think about the ethics of history and the stories that I was telling from 100 years ago as well. And I was just really pleased that I was able to convey positive messages from 100 years ago because that was literally what I'd seen. I wasn't massaging the story. There had been moments of panic. There had been huge moments of confrontation, particularly political confrontation between the states and between the states and the Commonwealth in 1919. And we saw it again in 2020. But broadly, I actually felt I had a very positive message to tell about how Australians had been inclusive, had cared about each other, and had operated at a very community level in 1919 and again in 2020. So it was nice to actually be able to share those parallels from history to the present. And it didn't mean that there's something in our national ethos, I think, that drove that process, but it did mean I could talk to my son, who was 18 at the time, about the idea of social capital. And actually say, you know, there is something in this idea that as a society, each society is willing to give up a certain amount of itself. You know, individuals are willing to give up a bit of themselves to put into the common good. And I think in a crisis like 1919 and again in 2020, we as a national community showed a great deal of social capital. You know, the way that we almost instantly combined our private and public health systems was extraordinary. In 1919, there was no Department of Health. There were a state level, but no Commonwealth one. That was a really important parallel to make as well, that we had come a long way in understanding that health is a national priority and a national imperative, but it's also something we enact as individuals too.
So how do we then remember the stories of those who perhaps aren't recognised on this more national level? I mean, one of the things that we know is that COVID-19 didn't have the same effect on everybody. And there's a lot of data now that shows that women bore the brunt of the lockdown, both as the workers, but also the workers from home in terms of looking after the children and everything. Now, traditionally, it's really hard to find records of women in the archives. How did you find experiences of women? How do you know how they experienced the influenza outbreak of 1919? I'm never going to call it the Spanish flu ever again.
It was one of the fantastic outcomes of the project that I'd been involved with in 2018, which was how I just happened to be on the spot in 2019. So through the Royal Australian Historical Society, you know, we have an imperative to encourage research in Australian history, but also increasingly we're pushing family and local historians to publish or to share their research. And there's often that big leap in community history between having a look at the records and then feeling confident and comfortable enough to actually share it as well. So we set up this project, which we called an intimate pandemic, very much around that idea of, okay, how did something as enormous as a pandemic affect your local community or your family in 1919? That was actually the whole point of that initiative. So we really rolled it out at a regional level. I did what I called the flu roadshow of country towns in New South Wales, which was a great opportunity to get out and talk to people who were doing community history. And I certainly don't want to take any credit for all the results of that work, because a lot of people were doing these projects anyway. And we were just trying to encourage people who were giving them the background and giving them some tools like a research guide and a platform where they could publish some of this material. But we also went out and proactively gathered it as well. For instance, I think in New South Wales, I gathered over 30 community histories of the pneumonic influenza pandemic or Spanish flu. And when I'd been out looking at those community sources, I actually saw that they did capture a lot of those forgotten voices. So if you go back to the academic historiography on the flu pandemic from 1919, you see it's largely focused on where you'd expect in state and national archives. And it's a lot about the politics. It's a lot about the bickering between the states and the Commonwealth and the military authorities and the civilian authorities and the medical decisions that were being made at a very high level. All the stuff you'd expect to see in a government archive. But when you go back and look at what community historians have been doing, they are looking at their family, they're looking at memories that have come through, they're looking at the local newspaper, they're looking at cemetery, you know, at headstone transcripts. They're actually finding a lot of those stories. You know, there was some great stuff coming out of schools, for instance, as well. And I think this was a really interesting case where, you know, I'm a big fan of Trove and the digitized newspapers. I have some methodological concerns about people thinking that what went into the newspapers is true. But in 1919, they're amazing because in that moment, the system broke down. Local councils were actually incredibly important in the way we managed that pandemic in 1919 in ways we can't imagine now, because health and care were really community-based back then. There were state health departments, but there was no Commonwealth health department. So care was being managed at a very local level. But it was being swamped. You know, the local health officer, the local GP, the local town clerk, the local mayor, they were the ones out driving cars, delivering blankets and broth to people. So record keeping broke down. And you actually see that when you go through the records, you actually can see the system falling apart, you know, things getting jumbled out of date and entries stopping and all that sort of stuff. So when record keeping breaks down, actually, in that moment, it's the local reporter who's hanging around outside the hospital or outside the police station, or outside the GP's house, records a lot of that local history in a way I am more comfortable using than in any other moment in Australian history. And it's in those sources, whether it's cemetery records or local council records or in the local rag, that's where you find the women and the other people whose stories don't often come out. You also get to hear about the naughty ambulance horse who kept untying his reins and wandering off back home while the ambulance officers were inside dealing with a patient, come out and find there's nowhere to put their stretcher. So you get some amazing local flavour in there. But en masse, when you collate all those histories, you actually see it is the ordinary people whose stories are being told. And they are the people, as we saw last year, who stepped up and actually provided that care in the heat of the moment.
Peter, we're going to have to start wrapping things up shortly, unfortunately, but I wanted to circle back to the point you made a moment ago about there was a real desire last year for people to be fed the lessons of history. And I certainly noticed that phrase circulating a lot. Everyone was asking, you know, what can the influenza pandemic of 1918 teach us
about 2020. And I certainly share your misgivings with that kind of very neat, pat kind of utilitarian idea of history. But there clearly was this great hunger last year for history. And so I'm interested in your thoughts about if history can't kind of teach us neat lessons, what does it give us at a time of crisis like the COVID-19 pandemic?
Look, I do think it has a pedagogical value, and I do think there are parallels, and I think maybe parallels are better than cycles, because at least with the parallel you realise that things look similar or are aligned but are different as well. You know, they're separate entities. They were some of the things that I saw that did make sense from 1919. So, for instance, quarantine worked in Australia in 1919 up to a point, and then it broke. But then it worked again. And that was one of the issues that came out a lot in the political debate about states closing borders. And there was a lot of angst about political point scoring and about premiers, you know, being protective of their jurisdiction. But the point was actually forgotten that we could have picked up from history is that that still works. One person with COVID or one person with pneumonic influenza in your state doesn't mean the whole state's infected. And keeping the border closed actually will slow the rate of infection and spread and will actually enhance your ability to control that outbreak. So there were no aircraft flying into Australia in 1918 or 19. So the maritime quarantine held for 3 months and then the flu got in. The maritime quarantine didn't stop. They didn't say, oh, well, bugger it, it's all lost. You know, let's let everybody in. They kept that up, which meant that A, the quarantine had worked at keeping out the most virulent strains. So when the flu came ashore, it was less deadly than the version that hit New Zealand 3 months earlier. So that was valuable. And so they kept up the maritime quarantine. And yes, there was the politics of state versus state, but actually shutting the borders, as we've seen in Australia with COVID, it does actually slow the spread. Being able to look at those historical parallels and say, actually, there was value in that. We understand that there's politics and, you know, whatever, but there is actually a public health outcome that we can model and we can use again too. So I guess that was one example where I thought they were parallels, but then of course we know the health systems are so dramatically different. There was no such thing as acute care in 1918. You know, they barely had blood transfusions then. Nobody could even see what the influenza virus looked like until the 1930s. And there were certainly no antiviral drugs. And, you know, so there were so many things that were different back then as well, which meant that COVID was infinitely less deadly in Australia than even the pneumonic influenza pandemic had been a century earlier.
To go back to the ideas of digital history, let alone contract tracing.
Yes.
Which obviously
was not huge in
1919 as well. Peter, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for coming along. And don't forget, you can catch up on all of season 1 and 2 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can learn more about Peter's work via his University of Sydney profile. And you can follow him on Twitter at History2Wheeler. And don't forget to check out hashtag COVID Street Archive.
Until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded by King Sound Studio in Sydney and produced by La Trobe's Matt Smith. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, which you can hear more of at soundofpicture.com.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
Coming up in the next episode.
Who bought this book here? That's not a question that anybody else, I think, would have got quite so obsessed about and spent 7 years trawling the archives in search of an answer for. So in some ways, that is very much about me.